Good afternoon. Thank you for braving the weather to join us today. My name is Moying Li. I'm on the board of Massachusetts Center for the Book. On behalf of the center, I'd like to welcome you to today's panel of Massachusetts fiction writers on their craft and culture. First of all, a few words about our organization. The Center for the Book was founded by the Congress Library of Congress in 1977 for the purpose of promoting reading, books, libraries, and enhancing literacy. In 1984, the Federal Center began to establish state affiliations, and ours is one of them. Now, we work with a network of centers for the book across the United States. In Massachusetts, our center administers, among other programs, an annual book awards. And today, all three authors here have been recipients of our awards in fiction. Interestingly, each of them has written a significant work recently critiquing and analyzing their craft and our culture in general. We're very pleased they have agreed to get together today and share their thoughts with us on this critical turn. And I'm honored to introduce the moderator for the panel, Svan Berkets. We could not have hoped for a better moderator. Svan is the author of 10 books, including Gutenberg Elegies, The Fate of Reading in the Electronic Age, and The Art of Time in Memoir. Until recently, he was the director of the Bennington Writing Seminars and has also taught at Harvard and Mount Holyoke College. At present, he is the editor of the literary journal Agni, based out of Boston University. Without further ado, Svan.
Thank you. I think I'm going to start, before we actually talk, just by giving a very brief introduction to my three panelists. And I think I'll go from here to here to here. And so on my left is Gish Jen. Her 2013 book was drawn from the Massey Lectures delivered at Harvard. It was called Tiger Writing, Art, Culture, and the Interdependent Self. She lives in the Mecca of Cambridge, is a second-generation Chinese-American, a graduate of the Iowa Writing Program. She has published three novels, including Mona in the Promised Land and Typical American, as well as several works of nonfiction. To my next left is Chris Castellani. He's the author of three novels, including All This Talk of Love. He is the artistic director of Grub Street and teaches at Warren Wilson College. And he's also the author of the recent The Art of Perspective, Who Tells the Story, which is part of the reason we're here. And Chris lives in Boston. Way over there, the promised land is Margot Livesey. And she has her own connections to the Iowa Writing Program. She teaches there. She's the author, most recently, of Hidden Machinery, Essays on Writing, as well as a trove of novels, eight of them, counting the most recent, which is Mercury. All three of our writers have an enviable slew of awards and honors, and you can look those up. They just take me so much time. So we're going to get started. Before, I was given a reminder that there is a book signing table in the back, and that after this, if you want, the authors, and I don't know if me, but we'll be back there for a while. So to get started, and really, as someone famous once said, I've been waiting for this all my life, there's this question. I mean, it's deep in the heart of things I think about, and to have it actually be offered to me as a topic for a panel was kind of a very special surprise. It was E.B. White who said, and I don't mean any analogies here, but you don't ask a pig how to make bacon.
So glamorous.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, okay. So what we have, people maybe too readily always think, oh, so-and-so is a writer, written a few novels, a couple books of criticism. And I say, wait a minute, let's slow this down and look. Because in my own experience, and I will just see if you agree with me or not, but the writing of fiction comes out of one area of the life and the mind and the imagination. The writing of anything that's non-fictional comes from somewhere else. So we're bringing together an interior kind of an interior, what is it? It's interior. We're bringing that together with a very different, I think, exterior manifestation. And just, does anyone disagree with this difference? Because you both have spent time in both parts of the woods. And I sort of want to get close to this, because the point here was to see three very talented and successful novelists talk about fiction, but I want them to talk first about the inside part of things and then later see how the connection is made and what they bring to bear when they write in any sort of descriptive or evaluative way about literature or craft. So, I wanted to start with the idea of style and the development of style. And what I'd like to do is ask, again, we'll just go in this sequence. Is that right? I want to ask each, well, I put a question to my panelists a few weeks ago, and I asked them to pick a passage that they think more or less exemplifies what they regard as their basic style, you know, kind of the water table at which they work, and each has obliged. And I thought what I'd do is get each of my panelists to read the passage. These will be short, but they'll give you the sound of the author. But then also start to talk a little bit about how you came to that style. What was your, it's a hard question, but, you know, one has one's subjective life, there are books read, there are mentors, there's an educational process, there's the current literary climate and other literary climates. Somehow out of all of that, each person evolves a style. And I want to start there. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you just start with your comments about interior and exterior. Because I would say that, you know, when you ask about this, would we read something that was representative, I immediately bridled. I'm sure my fellow authors did too, because we've written so much over the years. You know, I mean, writing for 25 years, nothing is representative. But what is true is that I do think that we, so I don't know if I have a representative style, but I do have a representative approach. Mm-hmm. And the representative approach is, you know, I have always worked by kind of trying to identify the places where I rub against the world. You know, Gertrude Stein once said the artist works by locating the world in himself. We all wish that she had said herself. Mm-hmm. But I think that we develop certain nerves as a result of our contact with the world. And my experience has been that if you can locate that nerve and you can write on that nerve, you will have a story. And so, like I said, so I don't have a representative style, but I do have a representative approach.
Okay.
And in this, I think you can hear, you know, what the nerve was and why I did this. I will say that this piece that I'm going to read from, just one paragraph, this is a story called Mr. Crime and Punishment and War and Peace. And I will say also that I think that this method of working tends to result in humor. And this is a piece that I wrote actually because the ACLU was putting together an anthology to raise money, and they asked would I write for them. And so you'll hear this does involve a law school student, and you know, so you can see also all the elements. You know, there's something out there I'm trying to write for the ACLU, law is on my mind, and then where, if I were in that world, where would my nerve be?
That's a good
okay.
word.
And so this goes, Roger Rabbit, we called him. Jabbertalky, evermore. But mostly we called him Gunner Summers. And it wasn't just the Asian Americans. It was pretty much all his fellow 1Ls, that's the first year law school students, the immigrants from Azerbaijan and Poland and Brazil, the students who were born here too, but who had been brought up to be respectful of others, kids of cops, farmers, teachers. We analyzed Gunner en masse. It was his upbringing, his genes, his ego. It was his insecurity, related perhaps to the fact that this was not exactly Harvard Law School we were attending. I was not of the persuasion that it was Gunner's looks, too, that gave him the idea that he was entitled to more airtime than other human beings. But others maintained that there was a chart somewhere showing correlation, if not causation. Rugby build plus blonde locks put you at risk, especially if you played tennis, sailed, and had really wanted to take Swahili, but in the end had been forced to admit it wasn't as useful as French. In truth, there weren't a lot of people like Gunner in our ranks, people born with silver spoons in their mouths, in their hands, in the air. This was a fourth-tier school. But he inspired an expansion of our vocabularies anyway. By the end of the first month, everyone in our section could not only define, but spell logorrhyic, pleonastic, periphrastic. Indeed, you might have been forgiven for thinking we were strangely supersized contestants preparing for the script's spelling bee.
Style is a hard one, right?
It is. That's why I brought it up.
Thanks for that. I teach a lot. I know we all teach or have taught in writing programs, and we spend so much time, at least I do in my classes, talking about the more practical elements of writing, plot, character development, point of view, structure. And style has always come up as the thing that everyone claims, and I think I feel this way myself, is this sort of innate, this thing that is uniquely yours that you almost can't define and don't want to define. And so I haven't actually spent much time interrogating that. What I have thought about is we only teach in, well, at least I only know how to teach in metaphors. And when it comes to the metaphor of writing, I always think about the garden and the garage. And when I'm working on a new piece, when I'm dreaming, when I'm kind of getting stuff down, when I'm developing the characters, I feel like I'm in the garden. It's that time when I'm not questioning. It's the time when I'm letting myself go. And that's where the style, I think, starts to emerge, the style of each piece. And that it's not until you kind of bring it into the garage and you start to look at it more closely and pick it apart, can you see how you can make the style like a better version of itself. And to brush away the stuff that's occluding the style or that's corrupting the style of that particular piece. That's the way I've always approached it. And for this, I have a novel coming out in February, and for this, for the approach to the story, I always had a situation that I was interested in. I was interested in a relationship between two people, Tennessee Williams and his partner. And I was fascinated by their relationship. I was fascinated by their life together. I read their letters. I reread Williams' work, all that. But I didn't have a story, and I didn't know who was going to tell it. But I just kind of spent a lot of time in the garden dreaming about it. And then what ultimately emerged is, I'm going to read just the first paragraph of this new book, which is set in 1953 in Italy. Truman, which is Truman Capote, Truman was throwing a party in Portofino, and Frank wanted to go. The invitation came in mid-July, slipped between parentheses in the long, gossipy paragraphs of his letter to Ten, as if daring him to acknowledge it. Frank read the letter in Ten's absence. He'd been stuck for weeks in their stuffy fourth-floor apartment on Via Firenze, waiting for him to get back from Spain, while on the loud streets below, the real Romans were escaping for the mountains. He replied to Truman with a brief telegram, and then he called the finest hotel in town, the Splendido, to book a room. He auditioned various linen jackets and swim trunks and hats in the mirror above the dresser, mended two pairs of 10 socks, and walked their silks down to the cleaners. When 10 returned home to find their bags lined up in the hall, packed for another trip, he didn't protest. He was sweet on Frank again after 3 weeks apart. A drive in the Jag up the coast of Liguria, far from the melting heart of the Centro, could only make things sweeter.
Okay, thanks.
I'm still grappling with Chris's metaphor of the garden and the garage. My garden is a place of unimaginable savagery where I'm always tearing out weeds and doing things with secateurs you don't want to know about. And my garage is like a delta that's always silting up with things. In fact, the neighbor's children came around the other day. They're aged 3 and 4, and they stood in the doorway of the garage and said, "You have too much stuff in here." And when I asked the solution, they said, "You need a second garage." So
that's your metaphor, the garage and the second garage.
I like that.
Thinking of style, I've been rereading Madame Bovary, and Flaubert said when he began writing that, his friend Louis was forcing him to use less poetic, less obviously lyrical language. And Flaubert said about the style he was trying to master in Madame Bovary, I have abscesses of style. My style is giving me hives. So I agree with my fellow authors. I'm always hoping to find a new style, a new voice. And in trying to write my most recent novel, Mercury, I went after one of the beloved voices of my childhood, the repressed Scottish man. Don't ask. And I apologize, as I have on many previous occasions, for the name of my protagonist. My mother called me after a favorite uncle who was, in turn, called after a Scottish king. Donald III was 60 when he first ascended the throne in 1093. He went on to reign twice, briefly and disastrously. I'll just say the first time he only reigned for less than a year. As a child, I hated my name. Other children sang, "Donald, where's your trousers?" in the playground. But as an adult, I've come to appreciate being named after a valiant late bloomer, a man who seized the day. Of course, most Americans, when I introduce myself, are thinking not about Scottish history, but about a cartoon duck. They are surprised when I tell them that a Scot invented penicillin and that James VI, for whom the Bible was so gloriously translated, was a keen amateur dentist. I used to believe that in my modest fashion I was contributing to the spread of Scottish values, thrift, industry, integrity. I have my own business, a full-service optometrist, in a town outside Boston. More than most people, I have tested the hypothesis that the eye is the window to the soul.
Thank you. So as I'm listening, since I knew we weren't going to be furthering the plot in this session, I was very much listening to cadence and rhythm, the way syntax structures particular sentences in the passages. My feeling is that, I mean, they say every fingerprint is different, and it's true, but if you look at a finger from here, they look all alike. And I'm thinking of whether there is a kind of accepted idiom of our time that everyone is working in, not slavishly, but just aware of through reading, through hearing other writers, and how that sort of plays against those things that make the voice particular, identifiable. So I guess I'm asking a question about influence, really. And you mentioned, you know, that beautiful sense of the friction. And that's a friction in a sense between you and the nerve and the encounter with the world. But I want to hear about the other influences that also come to play. Because, you know, we tend to write in the style of our age. I'm using style very broadly here. But I heard, you know, much kindred in the three passages read, even though they were all radically different in their subject matter. And I'm just going to be a bulldog about this, but I love to figure out how a serious writer across a lifetime of building a craft and finding a craft comes to where he or she is finally. And I know it's another elusive topic, isn't it? But maybe we can talk about the way you feel that the writing of our age impinges on or affects or shapes some of what you do.
Please, you know, he throws out some impossible question and says, and you can, well, okay, let me just sort of think, you know, I'm not sure that I can say what the fingerprint is, but I do think that there's a dominant agenda that goes with the novel in our time in America as we practice it, right? And, you know, and the agenda is the support of the individual against some, you know, kind of society, whatever that means, right? And so, you know, that is, it's very much related to the origins of the novel, and it informs the practice of most novelists, I would say. And it is something which, because of my particular cultural background, because I am the daughter of Chinese immigrants, something which I have struggled from day one. And I don't think it's really that surprising that the novel, as we practice it in America, is not practiced in China, or was not practiced very recently. I mean, you could sort of say the story of the stone is a novel. It is a long, you know, the Dream of the Red Tranger. I mean, it is a very long fictional work, but it does not center on the novel as we understand it. It has nothing to do with Henry James, like absolutely zero, right? Because it is much more a portrait of a family, you know, and an individual agency is not at the center of it. It's much more about, you know, forces on people than it is about a person standing up. And, you know, where we're much more like, well, what was this, you know, when we think about what we teach in fiction classes, you know, what, you know, who, well, first, well, the first question we ask is, whose story is this? I can see that to this day, whose story is it, is like a question that does not come up in my work until I am 7/8 the way through. And then I often have to say, okay, so because I have many people whose story this actually could be, and actually my subplots are often only that much less developed. Right. You know, the people who are not protagonists are only that much less developed than the protagonist. So it's not like the protagonist is the only one who has a huge central conflict and a huge developed interior life. Mm-hmm. You know, I often have 2, 3, 4 characters who are really just as conflicted and could easily be the protagonist. And so this is a way in which I feel that I am in constant conflict. You know, you can sort of see my Eastern heritage. And don't get me wrong, I was born here. You know, I was born in Yonkers, New York. So it's not like, you know, I was not raised in China. But even so, you can see that cultural heritage still at odds with the dominant American culture. That has been true. I felt it when I was in Iowa. It was the subject of my master's thesis when I was in Iowa. So, you know, I have felt it the whole way. And I'll just stop there because I'm sure everyone
people have other things to say. Let me just follow it with a quick question is whether you encounter that friction naturally because of, you know, the culture you were raised in, or do you also use it as a conscious part of, I mean, do you set out in any way, like you mentioned the layers of, you know, characters and the notion of a kind of decentered, ultimate, character-wise, a plot. And I'm just curious, how much is conscious, or do you sort of pick your situation and then trust that the you who have developed your writing sensibility will write that situation. I mean.
Well, you're asking, so how have I negotiated this?
Yes.
Is this you're sort of saying? You know, so I can see the problem, and I did see it from very early on. Mm-hmm. And the answer is that with my different books, I have solved it in different ways. You know, in World and Town, you know, have sections where different protagonists dominate different sections. Something many people have done as well. But I think I had to do it for maybe a different reason. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So it was less that I thought of it as alternative, as more a way of resolving this problem in a way that was where it was sufficiently resolved to get it by Knopf, which is my publisher. You know.
Yeah.
And so different things. But I do think also, if you want to know about the critical turn, you know, so it's the whole way I'm writing along, and I'm feeling this really pretty much with every book. I do notice that I have a very, I have a very strong reaction against certain writers, you know, Knusgaard now, you know what I mean? I just feel like I cannot begin. I'm just not that interested. I feel it's really kind of rude, as you can imagine, from this thing about, you know, Gunnar Summers and, you know, takes up all the airspace. I feel like I really do not like people who take up all the airspace that way. And I do not celebrate it. I have very mixed feelings about Philip Roth. You know, you can imagine how I felt about Kavanaugh.
Right.
I'm sure that is related to my critical turn. I mean, I was asked to give these lectures at Harvard, and so it's not like I just spontaneously, decided I had to hold forth on this subject. But when it was clear that I had to give these lectures and I had to talk about something with fiction, you can sort of see how that leapt right in. And so that I did develop a kind of an analytical focus, analytical frame that would help me deal with my own internal problem. Mm-hmm. And that, involved, as I don't need to tell you, looking a lot of studies and all kinds of things. It helped me understand what this was that I felt. And now I can say with more clarity, I think, I'm better able to articulate, something that I had always felt like, why is it that Philip Roth drives me crazy? Do you know what I mean? Like, why do I feel like certain books, I just don't want to hear so much from you, why did I have that feeling? And now I can actually look and I can say, oh, and that's why I always loved Grace Paley.
There you go.
And that's why I always felt just so aggravated that she somehow never greeted with the kind of critical acclaim than Philip Roth was. This, it used to be just a gut feeling, but now I have the framework.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Over to you, Chris.
No, I was thinking of our mutual friend, Tom Mellon, who he often complains how depopulated the novel has become over the years, that when you sit down with a novel, I mean, this is, of course, a broad, broad generalization. There are many, many, many exceptions. But how you are kind of stuck with one person, usually, and one mood, one development of a character. And when it is, when there are multiple characters, because I think what you're saying is absolutely true, that the reviews almost pit the critical response to the novels often pit the characters and the sections against each other, right? Like, well, this character was more interesting than the other character in this book. So the books, so the novels themselves become this kind of athletic field where the characters are competing with each other. And I think we go into books, thinking that, which part am I going? And I mean, as we're writing it, thinking, well, this part seems to be more interesting to my reader. Therefore, you're asking about process, right?
Yeah.
So when we're getting feedback from our friends and agents and editors who are reading it, we say, oh, this is where the energy is. Therefore, I have to privilege this. Therefore, I have to develop this. And then it narrows the novel into this one mode of, this one character, this one storyline. And then the depopulation keeps happening. And there's something about the market, and there's also something about absolutely this is how I was taught in my MFA program. This is how this is what keeps getting repeated in MFA programs, and especially since most first novels are somewhat autobiographical, and some fifth novels are equally autobiographical, depending on the author. that since that first novel, since that first book is usually that person's story, sort of thinly veiled, that's where it starts, and then it just keeps getting repeated, you know. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. I'm just thinking about what everyone's saying. It's so interesting. I love your talking about why your novels are so spacious, mm-hmm. Gish. It gives me a whole new way of thinking about them, and it's one of the things I love and admire. It's interesting how there is a kind of suggestion that in writing novels, one ought not to address current affairs in any way. I loved A Little Life, but one of the things I and every other reader commented about was the absolute exclusion of broader politics in favor of very dramatic personal politics. And I don't know if we feel that nowadays. I think nowadays the world feels sufficiently urgent that probably most writers of whatever age and stage are going to start as part of their style, including more of the outer world. And I think one of the reasons people sometimes go back to write historical novels is because they feel a certain freedom, indeed a duty, to include the wider world as part of their style.
So I want to start edging this toward the craft part of the program, but I want to get there through kind of a middle path and ask about teaching. I know that both of you teach writing workshops and have for many years. I'm not sure if you
teach and writing. I have taught and am still teaching.
Yeah, okay. I wasn't
from time to
quite
time.
Sure. Okay, so you're all on the same ground here. We were talking about sort of early development and the formation of a sensibility. But now each of my panelists has been in the position, as I have too, of sitting in a room around a big rectangular table with 8 or 10 or 12 aspiring writers who have passed around their manuscripts and everyone's read it and thought about it. So writer in charge has to both communicate some notion of a standard and also has to communicate some, at least with the student, you know, make judgments and calls on what works and what doesn't. And I think probably everyone's the product of that process as well as now the proponent of it. But these are sort of decisions that are made, and I wonder sometimes on the basis of what one's writerly instinct feels that you need to do this with the character, or your situation is too, you know, it's all coming from somewhere. So I'm curious, since you've all written about writing and to some degree proposed views, you know, clear views about, you know, aspects of fiction and what works and what doesn't and what are the elements. I wonder, as a hypothetical, you know, so we talked about kind of a general style of the times, but you're in a workshop and mostly there's a kind of recognizable range within which most work falls. And I imagine as instructors, we adjust ourselves to that and try to figure out the writer's aspiration and guide them to it as well as we can do. But if we're teaching in this basic mode and suddenly a young Donald Barthelme appears in class and hands over a story which is just so wigged out in so many respects, you know, how do we react? How do we react to the outlier?
We jump for joy, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, I don't want to speak for you guys, but I feel like those are the most exciting moments, right? When this thing comes to you, that's kind of this, sometimes a beautiful mess, you know, but you can see the voice, the energy, the uniqueness, the whatever that's been freed from these kind of influences that we're talking about. I always try to, you know, my mantra, which is a cliche at this point, but it's sort of what we all, I think, try to do, is basically look and help the writer to see the story or piece of writing, a poem, whatever, on its own terms, and then try to make it a, help the writer make it a better version of itself, versus try to fit it into what our notions of what it should be, and try to discern, however possible, what the intention of the piece is, what it's trying to do, and what's getting in the way, and then teaching the writer, like, okay, you know, when you know, because you're using this point of view, or because you're using this kind of lyrical language, it's having this effect. So, and sometimes the writers, especially when they're starting out, don't really fully understand the effect that the choices that they're making are having. And so that it really becomes about describing their own piece to them, and that in itself is a kind of, is I think all we can do for writers is basically they're handing it to you and they're saying, I don't know what this is, help, tell me what this is and how I can make it a better version of itself.
Yeah, I mean, there are general precepts I think that we all more or less accept and work with, and they involve the creation of tension or suspense or developing the character more clearly or, you know, striking up a conflict that moves the narrative forward. Oh, I just lost it. I had a nice, lovely build-up in that sentence and slipped away. Oh, well, I was going to actually direct something to Margot here having to do, again, with the workshop experience and, you know, working on a student's manuscript that day, and your sense from having read it is that, you know, the character is not strong or clear or doesn't contain enough unknowns or whatever is the thing. I think, I wonder what you are relying on. And this, I think, is sort of also what I'm drilling toward. It's whether you're referring to a kind of general broad rule book about these things, or whether you finally have gotten to a point as a writer where you trust yourself as the tuning fork, which is maybe all you can do, is, you know, my instinct from having read thousands of books and from doing this myself is that, what? Oh. Yeah, I mean, how much is it instinct, finally?
I think it's, you know, as someone who swore she would never enter a classroom again after doing a BA, and has now spent a lot of time in classrooms, I think it's finely honed instinct. But we talk a lot about reading as a writer, but I think involved in style is looking at the world as a writer, seeing as a writer, noticing the details that may go unobserved, registering the emotions that we don't focus on or don't choose to talk about. So I'm always hoping that my students will find those telling details, the details that will bring the world of their fiction, the world of their characters into focus. And often the details they first write down are not the details they really need. They're placeholders for something much better.
I find as just having, I've never taught fiction in a workshop, but I've taught nonfiction for many years, and I often liken the process, at least at the MFA level, it's part therapy and part instruction, but so much depends not only on reading the words on the page of the student, but reading the student in order to sort of, again, it's intuition, you're trying to intuit what they most want to express. You try to get some sense of how their psyche works, and, you know, you often use their own prose to partly deduce that. And I feel that, you know, in that setting, each student is a separate course of instruction, though overall there are basic broad things that you try to impart that are relevant to all. And so now we're getting, moving down the line here, but these craft books, well, craft book, and sort of craft book, just because yours is less instructional and more reflective across a larger thematic area. But where did you get the gall? Where did you get the gall to write these essays in the, you know? At a certain point in your life, I think you feel that you've become qualified. You wouldn't have written that book at 28 or 35, probably, even had you been offered to write it. But something clicked and said, and maybe the offer was the right one or something, but I'm going to start writing these essays, and I'm going to step into my tone, my voice, and my judgments, and I'm going to try to talk about what I do from various angles by way of various, you know, writers and books and so on. What was the question buried in there? There is one. Or just jumping in and being a critic of sorts.
I would just say briefly that I think we each had some external goad to write our nonfiction books, giving the wonderful lectures at Harvard, and Chris part of the fantastic Grey Wolf series, and my book came out of talks and lectures at various conferences. So I think we needed encouragement to step forward and to proclaim, as it were. We weren't necessarily setting up to do
right.
it. I'm conscious we do want to make time for the audience to ask questions, so I don't want to hold forth for too long.
I've been resolutely looking this way, and there's the sign telling me to start questions. All right, instead of... Yes?
Because I've been very, and it's sort of coming out of the discussion. Who are you writing to in your criticism? Are you writing to your students? Are you writing to other writers? Writing to yourself and hoping that you... that's what I'm curious about. Mm-hmm. Is it a different audience? And what if you could riff on that?
Did everyone hear that?
No.
Okay, the question was asked of our three panelists who they feel they're writing to, whether it's students, general audience, fellow writers, and I think it's a good question.
Well, it goes back actually to what you were asked at the very start about sort of internal and external and kind of the difference between our... I think that, and this goes back to what you were saying about the garden and in the sense that I think that there's a way in which fiction, when you start to write fiction, at least for me, there is no audience. I mean, you are mucking about in the garden. You really, if you know that there's an audience, but it's far, 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 far away. And I do think that there's a way in which, when I sat down to write nonfiction, I had a much clearer audience. Now, in the case because my first nonfiction book were this collection of the Massey lectures for Harvard, I saw a room just like this, full of Harvard professors.
Right.
It was very clear. it was very clear. And then I went on to write another nonfiction book, that was based on that. That's Girl with the Baggage Claim, which is also about East-West differences in self. And, and there I did also have in mind people for whom, who were tortured by this. That was the obvious audience were people who had been in both cultures, who could see that there was a huge, students from another culture, they could see that there was a huge gap. So anybody who did not feel that there was a gap, that was not my audience, And there is no question that that stance brings out a very different part of the brain, because it is much more, you see the person, you see that they have a problem, or that they're a professor and they just want to... but you see that there's something that you want to tell them, and you're much more aware of what that is. It's a much firmer thing. It's like, I have this in me, I am going to give it to you, audience, and I'm just going to think about how to do that. Mm. Fiction is a whole different thing.
Right.
There's nothing anywhere near anything so purposeful or directed about it, at least in my experience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and there are two, very different audiences for me, for nonfiction and fiction. Very similar, to the way you describe. I feel like I start writing fiction mostly for myself, and to think of myself as the only audience, because really the actual audience is not much bigger than myself. So I better please myself first, otherwise, and I have a big Italian extended family, so at least they'll buy the book, but. When I started writing this book, The Art of Perspective, it was, as Margot said, similarly, I had given some lectures at conferences, that were specifically geared toward aspiring and emerging writers, and I taught a lot of workshops. And one thing I noticed was that so many students in the workshop, when I would ask them, why is this character telling the story, and why is it organized this way with this point of view, and they said, well, that's just how I started it. That was my way into it. I never really thought about what impact that had on the story, and that kind of blew my mind, because when I write my own fiction, that is really the thing that I think of the most, is who's telling the story, and not necessarily whose story is it, but who's telling the story and how it's being told, the form, the container for the, you know, the narrative. And so I thought, okay, well, I want to write a book, I want to write this essay about how narration works and what are different approaches to various forms of narration. And for me, I did it actually as again, it all comes back to me, because I also wrote it because I couldn't figure out how to write, like, who was going to tell the next book that I wanted to write. I had all the material, I had all the research, I had the situation, as I said, but I didn't have the story, and I needed to figure out who was going to tell it and why. And so I thought, okay, I want to write this book so I can figure it out. And then I I had myself in mind again, but I also had these students in mind, and also teachers to use in the classroom if they so wanted to. Yeah. So.
And I think one of the things that persistently interests me about fiction writers as a tribe is that they are somewhat anti-intellectual. They, in a sense, sometimes don't want to think very much about their own process. Mm-hmm. If you ask a young writer, what is your aesthetic? they won't be able to answer, although I can answer for them. Mm-hmm. I know what their aesthetic is if I've read enough of their work, even if they don't. If I ask, who are you writing against? Mm-hmm. Or what are you writing towards? I mean, fiction writers tend to be rather unreflective, and I think that can work up to a certain point. And then I think if you want to keep going, if you want to keep aspiring to getting better, you do need to become a bit more intellectual, a bit more thoughtful and analytical and aware of your work. And I'd say that the essays in my book are all about what I perceive as the hidden machinery of writing fiction, and how can we understand that machinery a little bit better.
Yes. There's a hand back there by the... Oh, I'm sorry. You first, and then back there. Actually, we have somebody, and then you.
So you in the front.
Yeah, you with the mic.
Oh, okay.
Ask you. No, I know. It's...
So I just have to preface this that saying I come to writing by way of oral storytelling, where you get to sometimes, if you're lucky, shift how the story goes. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be wedded to that one word on the page and not shifting it ever again. And yet, sometimes, you know, in my experience in writing, it was like, you know, I wanted to go here, and my characters made the decision. You know, it's like almost a voice going, no, I'm sorry, but this is how it ends. This is what happens. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that, some of those moments where, like, you really wanted to go here, and, like, maybe you even argued with yourself as you went there, and you, and the story said, no, we're going there.
Well, Nabokov, never afraid of political incorrectness, regarded his characters as galley slaves. They did what he wanted or else. but I think we all hope to have moments. I mean, this sounds like a wonderful experience in your work, to have those moments when a character is sufficiently alive that they do something that really surprises us in a wonderful way.
You know, I think that's related to why we're anti-intellectual, because I think we see the intellectual part of ourselves as kind of having an agenda and, you know, an outline, you know, yeah. 1, 2, 3, you know, 1A, 1B, 1C. Yeah. And actually that is just totally not where fiction lies.
Yeah.
I mean, it is in this character, you know, who up and steals the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that because we're trying to get to that moment that you're talking about, and we're kind of filtering for that, there's a way in which you want to turn off the intellectual part, because we see the intellectual part is in the way of the actual project. Because in the end, just as you were saying, you know, we want it to live, you know? And we want it, you know, and, this, you know, Margo, you're talking about the details that you're trying to get your students to hone in on. We are trying to defamiliarize, right? So we are trying to get you to see, to really re-experience the world, you know, as it really is and as it really comes to you live. And that involves, yeah, shutting all kinds of things off. And anyway, but your experiences, yes, it's, you know, we would love, by the way, to be able to also just kind of change everything once they've written it down.
Absolutely.
I mean, that would be great.
Absolutely.
But in a general kind of way, I think that you understand very much, you know, the actual fictive impulse.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, you guys said it very well. When I get to, you should probably get to the next question.
Question back there.
Yeah. Okay, well, first of all, thank you, everyone, for being here. I just actually have a question. When I was young, I remember being in elementary school and going to a film with friends and being told that as an Asian American, like the Russians, I could never be the protagonist. I would always be the evil character. And, of course, I was quite kind of that was controversial in my mind, and so I rebelled by reading all Asian American literature and Russian literature. So, believe it or not, I've actually read the love letters between Vera and Vladimir because of that child from elementary school. But I guess I wanted to ask you, because Gishjen, I've read you, but also just all three of you, as you guys published, there is that art to kind of getting through the publishing house. How much freedom do you think you guys had early on in your careers to really write what you wanted to and kind of break stereotypes? I've had a few friends try to go into writing, and they were somewhat pressured to do a facsimile of the Joy Luck Club and, you know, write stories that were a little bit tropey. So I would love to hear the freedom that all of you guys feel you had. Thank you.
You know, I will say, as an Asian American, I have been just unbelievably lucky, and so my experience is so atypical that I almost hesitate to share it, because I do know that there is huge pressure, and that many people, and you don't, it's not just a matter of being Asian American, it's being gay, it's being Scottish, I'm sure. I mean, it's well, the commercial world, you know, in the end, the publishing houses have to sell these books, and they are, you know, it's just like,
they have to package them.
Yes,
right?
Their ratings, so it's like ratings on TV, yes. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of, in the end, they have to come out, deal with the market, and that amounts to pressure on writers. But I myself have to say that I've experienced almost zero of that pressure. And even though I will say that I think that my house, Knopf, they have lost a ton of money on me. I wish it weren't true, but I know it's true. And I know it's true, and I know it's because of the kinds of freedoms that I've taken, so that I have not done what I'm supposed to be doing. And very happily for me, a Knopf, you know, is comfortable making lots of money on 50 Shades of Grey. and then floating certain writers. And I don't know how long that can go on for, but I will say that for whatever reason, they have floated me for, you know, 25, 30 years now. So, but that is so unusual that you really cannot extrapolate from that.
Yeah, I mean, there is this incredible tension, right? In the work that we do as writers, our goal is to make our work as complex, as contradictory, as layered as we possibly can, and to go against stereotypes and reinforce some strategically for a certain reason, all of these things. And then we hand it to the publisher, and their goal is to, again, to narrow it, to make it, to package it. These two things, art and commerce, are never going to live side by side in a way that's going to satisfy the artist. And the, you know, the new writer going into his or her first book, you're really at the mercy of, you know, often you're young, you're inexperienced, you're so excited to be published at all, and they have all this power, and they're saying, well, if we don't do this, you're not going to sell enough books, and then we won't be able to sell your second book, and you feel all this pressure. And I definitely felt that as an Italian writer, they wanted to make my first book as much of a romance as possible and make it as sun-splashed and again, romantic. I wanted to call it all these things, and the title that they ended up coming up with was one I never wanted, that they forced on me, that has actually set set my career on a path I didn't want it to be set on. And they didn't want me to talk about my, you know, that I was gay. They didn't want me to mention any of that. And I agreed with everything because I was afraid, you know, and I wish that I could go back and undo a lot of that, to be perfectly honest. So. Right, exactly.
That's terrible.
Do we have time for one more question?
Yeah, one more, I think. The gentleman with the hat on, the cap.
That is terrible.
Part of the discussion you guys were having about sort of the essential nature of style or how important style is, and you mentioned the prospect of encountering maybe someone like a young Donald Barthelme type character. And you also mentioned, though, how painful it can be to read someone like Nausgaard or reading about doing your kid's laundry or something and how it's supposed to be heroic. But on the flip side, I wonder, I found that Atessa Mosfeg has a lot of these stories in her collection, Homesick for Another World, that really express the primal sort of disgusting nature of everyday people, or these really, these pathologies. So I was wondering what you guys think about, on the nonfiction side, it can be incredibly dull to read these sorts of stories, but the style in the fiction seems, I don't know, how do you ride that fine line and bring out those sort of pathologies of people that are kind of primal or brutal or dull or not despicable even?
Is it something about being Scottish that everyone looks at me?
It was your Donald character.
I think we heard how dirty your garage was.
I think you're asking a fascinating question. I used to, for 7 years, I was the fiction editor of Plowshares magazine, and I would say that, and probably Sven has some version of this, that very, very quickly an author declares herself, that you know just within a sentence or two, is this a voice you want to listen to, you want to keep company with? And it may be as something as simple as the use of crepuscular or subordinate clause. But I do think there's a danger in writing about, you know, certain subject matter. We are really looking for style to transform it, as Flaubert was with the very bourgeois story of Emma Bovary. And style does transform and change content, I think, in literary fiction. So it can bring us the horrendous, it can bring us the tedious, it can bring us the dull. But it is a difficult undertaking.
It can bring us the tedious, and it can bring us the dull, but it must not be either tedious or dull.
Right. Yes.
Right. Exactly.
So we began on style, we ended on style, and everything else was in the middle of that. Thank you all for coming, and good questions. And my pleasure.